So it's a great pleasure to be here, and I thank you very much for the invitation. So before I am going to talk to you about the topic of our research, which is breast cancer, I would like to put this in a broader picture. And I'm showing you here the incidence of breast cancer plotted over the past kind of 30 years for different, incidence of cancer for different from different tissues, plotted over the past 30 years with data from the Research UK, Cancer Research UK. And you see in red females, in blue males, and then in green the average of the two genders. And you can see that stomach cancer has been decreasing, good news. Yes, supposedly because we deal with food in a better way by freezing it. Pancreatic cancer has been stable, lung cancer been decreasing for men, catching up in women who picked up smoking. And then you see here the breast, the prostate, and the testis all on the increase, and all these cancers arise from hormone-sensitive tissues. And I should say that this is age-adjusted statistics, and testicular cancer peaks in men when they are in their 30s. So there are many reasons to pay more attention to hormones that we find both in the body and the endogenous hormones and then exogenous as well as endocrine disruptors. Now, with regards to breast cancer, it's a disease that affects 1 in 8 women. And it's actually not one disease, but quite complex. We have 18 different histopathological subtypes and 5 or so molecular subtypes. And today I'm going to focus on the most frequent subtype, which are these called luminal A and luminal B, which represent the breast cancers which express the estrogen receptor. The risk to get breast cancer is linked to women's reproductive history. So we know that the risk increases with the number of menstrual cycles they experience during a lifetime. And there is a protective effect of early pregnancies. Yeah, hormone replacement therapy has been shown to affect breast cancer risk, and there is this concern that endocrine disruptors also play into the continuous increase we see in breast cancer incidence. So what we have been interested in is understand how the female reproductive hormones, where estrogen, progesterone, and prolactin are the main players, actually act on the breast. And we have learned a lot about how the hormones act at the molecular level by working with, and when I say we, I mean in the field, by working with simplified systems such as breast cancer cell lines that readily grow in vitro. Now these, however, are derived from pleural effusions, so they represent late metastatic disease. Yeah, they've been grown on plastic, and then we find that their difference has been between labs. So they are very distant from what actually happens in the human body. Now, you can also culture normal human breast epithelial cells. However, they lose the hormone receptors as you take them into culture. So we have been working a lot on developing relevant systems to study the question of how hormones act. And there's a lot you can do using the genetic tools that mice offer, and you can make nice recombination experiments in mice and make chimeric epithelia giving you very powerful tools. This we complemented also with ex vivo studies, which can be done both with mouse and human organoids, which, as you leave the cells in their cellular context, they preserve the hormone response. However, these don't last very long. And now, more recently, we've been able to humanize the mouse, and that is what I want to share with you today. So we finally have a system to study hormone signaling in human cells in physiologically more relevant conditions. And yeah, while we were interested in this from the aspect of understanding the mechanisms by which hormones control normal breast physiology and how they impinge on breast carcinogenesis, it's actually been a major issue in oncology in general that we have problems with our preclinical models, and which explains why so many drugs that are developed in labs ultimately fail when they are introduced into the clinics. In particular, in breast cancer, we have the issue that we lack in vivo models for the estrogen receptor positive subtypes. Yes, I told you those represent 75% of the disease. And we have a large repertoire of genetically engineered mouse models. However, for reasons we still poorly understand, the tumors that develop in these models are largely estrogen receptor negative. Yeah, there's one exception, which is the STAT1 knockout, where you get tumors to develop within 1.5 years. However, these actually also have major immune perturbations, so they are difficult to work with. Now, there are breast cancer cell lines, and although the estrogen receptor positive are clinically the most frequent subtype, they are not the most abundant, best represented among the cell lines. And out of the some 20 or so that exist, very few grow in vivo when xenografted into mice. And the very few cell lines that grow in mice will only grow there if you supplement the mouse with exogenous estrogens. Now, breast cancer is a disease that typically occurs in postmenopausal women who have very low estrogen levels. So when we study these cell lines as xenografts, yeah, we study them with unphysiologically high estrogen levels. Now, finally, it is increasingly realized that patient-derived xenografts approach the clinics better than these as grafted cell lines. However, large efforts, in particular done here in Paris at the Curie, show that it is very difficult, again, to get the ER-positive breast cancers to grow. There is a selection for high-grade cancers, and this large study out of the Institut Curie, which comprised more than 400 estrogen receptor-positive tumors, showed just a 2.5% engraftment rate. Now, recently, Carlos Caldas claims that he got more tumors to grow, but still, we are far from being very efficient. So what's been done is shown here. So typically, people inject 1 million dissociated tumor cells, be it a line or be it a tumor, into the subcutaneous or the mammary fat. And that itself causes the problems, because we are putting cells into a place where they don't originally belong. And by putting such a large number, you elicit inflammation, you elicit a lot of the cells will die, there is going to be a inflammatory response and scarring. So it's not a very well-controlled approach. And so we were very excited when Fari Babibov published another approach where she put tumor cells with the aim actually of studying in situ lesions through the teat into the ductal system. And we began to set this up in the lab, and I'm showing you here is a picture of a mouse mammary gland that was injected with trypan blue, and you can see on this whole mound how the blue has penetrated into all the milk ducts. And so we got hold of a number of breast cancer cell lines and started injecting them. And here you see what that gives rise to. So up here you have the MCF7 cells, which are ER positive, and T47D cells, another luminal cell line. And several months after they've been injected, you see how they lead to low foci of distended ducts. And interestingly, when we injected basal-like breast cancer cell lines, they became rapidly invasive, whereas all the ER positives stayed for a prolonged time in this intraductally. And of note, several cell lines that failed to grow in mice previously were now able to establish, in particular, the MDAMB134, which represents a lobular carcinoma for which so far no xenograft existed. And these cells now grow in the absence of any exogenous hormone supplement. So here I'm showing you side by side the MCF7 cells, grown in the fat pad on the left and intraductally on the right. And as typical of such xenografts, you see a couple of weeks after injection, you have a big tumor that's very red, highly vascularized, whereas with the intraductal approach, the mammary gland has hardly changed shape. And all you can see are these whitish lines which represent milk ducts distended by tumor cells growing inside. And we add with the cells prior to injection were infected with a luciferase-expressing lentivirus, and so we can trace their in vivo growth with luciferase measurements. And you see how the growth rate of the MCF7s growing in the fat pad is much higher than that of the MCF7 cells growing intraductally. The vascularization is reflected at the molecular level by CD31 staining here that is very widespread in the fat pad approach, and in the intraductal you just see that endothelial cells line the outside of the ducts. Most strikingly, cell proliferation is extremely high in the traditional xenografts and much lower by the intraductal approach, and that is actually much closer to what you observe in the clinics. Now, breast cancers are diagnosed typically through palpation. Women feel that there is a hardness in the breast, and that's due to deposits of fibrillar collagen. We see little of that in the fat bed, but we do detect fibrillar collagen in the intraductally injected model. And a last one, I got Yorgos, the postdoc who did this, very excited. Yeah, I sent him to do a mammogram. So he went with blocks in which he had embedded the fat pad and the intraductal tumor. And you see that there are no microcalcification here, but you can see the microcalcifications in the tumor that's growing intraductally. So in all senses, it seems to closely resemble the clinical disease. While on the hole mount pictures, it looked as if the tumor cells are localized intraductally. You can, however, detect invasive cells here traced with the human-specific probe, ALU. And with time, there's more invasion and metastatic cells can be detected in the vasculature here in a lymphatic vessel. Now, upon sacrifice of the animals, we take out the organs and assess them also for the luciferase activity. And here I'm showing you micrometastases that are detected. And you see that the incidence increases with time and multiple organs are affected. And interestingly, the bones are a frequent metastatic site, again, as is seen in the clinics. Here's an example of a lung metastasis that was detected with the ALU staining and which stained positive also for the estrogen receptor. So the model nicely recapitulates most of the stages of human breast carcinogenesis, starting from in situ lesions, going through invasion and up to metastasis. Now, what about the therapeutic response? So we treated tumors with tamoxifen and Faslodex, typical endocrine agents administered in the clinics, and you can see that they reduce the growth rates of the intraductally growing MCF7 cells. And we can also mimic a more frequent clinical setting in the advanced disease. So we wait until we have a signal that we know is already associated with micrometastasis, then initiate treatment, and you see it makes the tumor cells melt down in the glands, abrogates the expression of the hormone receptors, and abrogates the metastases in different organs. Now then Yorgos went on to collect cells of treated and untreated mice and profile them by RNA-seq. And interestingly, in the signature What predominated, here you see the bioinformatic analysis, was nice to see, the estrogen receptor pathway. And in the second position, there was an EMT signature. And that was important because Jenny Cheng had shown using human tumors that after chemo or endocrine therapy, she could detect an EMT signature in patient samples. So that again suggests that even the MCF7 that have so long been growing on plastic, yeah, put in this system, remember to react like a human tumor. Next, we compared the global gene expression profile to the profiles of breast cancer cell lines that had been characterized by Joe Gray. And here, I just want to point out, you see this big A is the are the MCF7 growing in the fat pad, the big B are the MCF7 cells growing intraductally, and you see how the intraductal MCF7 are close to the cluster of luminal cell lines, whereas the fat pad MCF7 are more with the basal cell line models. Yeah, for two other cell lines of basal origin that we put profiled in both sites, there was not a single gene that differed between the two sites, and consistently they cluster here together. Whereas the MCF7 showed more than 2,000 differentially expressed genes. Next, using the PAM50, we aligned it with patient samples, and again you see how the intraductally engrafted MCF7 are closer to the pertinent luminal human breast cancer samples. So in this setting, the MCF7 cells resemble patient tumors, yeah, both biologically and at the molecular level. Now, what was striking in the profiles was, the large number of differentially expressed genes, a lot had to do with cell proliferation, which was not surprising. In intraductally, the Hippo signaling pathway and the CXCR4 pathway were upregulated. And a lot was about cell adhesion, and EMT and basal markers were increased when the cells were injected into the fat pad. And so the gene set enrichment analysis confirms that there is an increased EMT signature. And by Western blot, we validated several of the differentially expressed genes. And so here you see, again, the MCF7 growing in the fat pad. This is a little bit giving up on me. I wonder whether this... Oh, yeah. growing in the fat pad intraductally. And here you have MCF7 cells growing in vitro, where they have a luminal expression pattern. And as a positive control for the basal markers, we took MCF10A cells. So you see that SLUG, Vimentin, and XNA are not detected in the ducts and in the MCF7 growing on plastic, but they are induced in the fat pad. And so is calveolin and integrin alpha-6 and the transcription factor P63. On the other hand, in the intraductal environment, you find increased expression of numerous receptors important in the physiology of the mammary gland, and the nuclear hormone receptor, the estrogen receptor, and the androgen receptor are strikingly increased in the intraductal site. Now, how do these changes come about? And for this, Yorgos did the following experiment. He injected the MCF7 cells first in the fat pad so as to induce this basal differentiation. And then he re-isolated them by fax. Yeah, and we have also a fluorescent marker in these cells. And then he injected them intraductally, and then that was the challenge, that he would look at different time points after injection. And so after day one, that's not terribly easy because you don't have that many cells present. And you can see here by the immunofluorescence that the estrogen receptor takes about 8 days to get expressed and then will be highly expressed by day 20. And that was confirmed by mRNA analysis for both the estrogen and the androgen receptor. Much more rapidly, however, you get a downmodulation of the basal markers, which is shown here, which in a day they are substantially downmodulated, and after 20 days they're almost absent. So we have two important transcription factors here that are involved in cell fate determination and maintain the balance between luminal and basal cell fate in the mammary gland, yeah, based on the work of many people in the field, that is P63 and SLUG. And so we went on to address what was the respective importance of these two factors in controlling the behavior of the these luminal breast epithelial cells in the model, and overexpressed both of them in the MCF7 cells that we grafted intraductally. And here you can see that P63 expression had no effect on their growth, whereas SLUG impaired the growth of the MCF7s. We also overexpressed it in the traditional settings where you graft the cells into the fat bed in the presence of an estrogen pellet, and it doesn't have a major impact on the growth of the cells. So this pointed to SLUG being more pertinent, and we then asked whether keeping SLUG low was in fact essential for getting these cells to grow in vivo. And so as we downmodulate SLUG, when we graft the MCF7 into the fat bed in the presence of estrogen, nothing much happens. And when we put MCF7 cells into the fat bed without estrogen, the control, as expected, doesn't grow. But now that we downmodulate SLUG, we actually get some growth, illustrating that indeed low levels of SLUG are very important for the luminal cancer cells to grow in vivo. Once they are intraductally, yes, SLUG is downmodulated by the microenvironment, further downmodulation doesn't have an effect. So now, how is the SLUG upregulation brought about as we put cells into the fat pad? And we noticed in the expression profile that TGF-beta signaling came up in various analyses. And in fact, it had been shown that specifically SLUG is induced by TGF-beta via SMART3. And so Yorgos did a Western blot here on the MCF7 cells in the fat pad, and intraductally you can see how phospho-SMART3 is upregulated in the fat pad. And so what we think is happening is that as we put these hormone receptor positive breast cancer cells, now I've only shown this for MCF7, as a model for hormone receptor positive breast cancer cells, into the fat pad, the stromal microenvironment, which is full of such factors as TGF-beta, induces the transcription of SLUG, and that results in establishment of a basal differentiation program with all these factors involved. Now, if we take the same cells and put them intraductally, that environment, that microenvironment, helps the cells upregulate the hormone receptors, growth hormone receptors, and maintain a luminal phenotype. So this is all very nice. Now, is this gonna help us move further to the clinics with these models? And so we've, through a long-standing collaboration with the clinics, been obtaining breast tumor samples. And from the operation theater, we collect very small pieces, as it happens, of breast tumors, dissociate them in the lab to single cells, and then infect with lentiviral vectors so that they will express GFP and luciferase. And then we place these cells intraductally. And lo and behold, this is a typical tumor spectrum in Lausanne. Yes, 10 out of the 11 tumors are ER positive. and all of these tumors engrafted. Yeah, the take rates, the engraftment rates here, tells you how many out of the total number of glands we engrafted were successfully engrafted. And as you see, it goes up over time as the users became better at the injections. And so then we can trace these patient-derived xenografts as they grow in mice. And it seems that in this site, the biological properties of normal and cancer cells are preserved, as illustrated by this graph. Yeah, so we only have one triple negative sample in here, but that was the tumor that grew fastest in the animals. We have distinguished here between two types of ER-positive, the non-specific types and the lobular. And there is this trend that the lobular, as is the case in the clinic, grows more slowly than the non-specific type. And then we have two types of, so to say, normal human breast epithelial cells, those derived from BRCA1 mutation carriers who went for mastectomies, and those from normal patients that go for reduction mammoplasties. And you also see there is a kind of a trend that the BRCA1 mutation carrier cells grow a bit better than the normal patient-derived samples. Now, in the model, we had this triple negative that we subjected to a clinically relevant treatment with four cycles of chemotherapy, and you see how the tumor here, the untreated one, melts down under the chemotherapeutic treatment, and it abolishes the metastases that are present in the untreated mouse. With regards to the hormonosensitive tumors, I'm showing you here five examples of tumors that we treated with Faslodex, and you see a response in four of those. The one that doesn't respond is a lobular that overexpresses HER2 that you don't expect to benefit from Faslodex. So it seems that the model is predictive. Now, is the model stable? For this, we were a bit in difficulties because the material we obtain is so small that we could not afford setting anything aside for sequencing of the fresh material. So the approach we took was to go back to paraffin blocks from the patient tumors and compare it to DNA isolated from the paraffin blocks of the PDXs, and then run IonTorrent and look at 50 frequently mutated genes. And there was no... We didn't detect any new de novo mutation in the PDXs, and you see that the spectrum of mutation closely matches that of the original patient tumor, with occasionally a mutation that is present in low frequency in the patient tumor not being detected in the PDX. So we hope now to take this model further and to refine it so that we can use it for personalized medicine and assist the clinicians in taking difficult decisions when it's unclear which particular therapy a patient could benefit from or whether at all a particular treatment is necessary. So, and this is just a glimpse on a project that we currently have in the lab where we are interested in understanding differences among different oral contraceptives. And Mari is a graduate student, is benefiting from creating such humanized mouse mammary glands, and now measuring, and this illustrates a bit the difficulties, with in different patient samples, the response to a given progestin. So, in summary, I've shown you that the microenvironment is really critical for ER-positive tumors, and that as we take hormone receptor positive breast tumor cells and put them in the fat pad, we induce a basal or EMT-like transition, so we start studying a different cell type from what we are interested in. And so this model now allows you, actually recapitulates most of the disease progress, including metastasis, which so far we could not study with xenograft models very well unless we injected the cells directly into the bloodstream or the distant site. We have a model for lobular carcinoma now, and the fairly normal endocrine milieu. And so we hope that we can take it on for personalized medicine. And of course, we have to bear in mind that we are working with immunocompromised mice, and we still need to face the challenge that ultimately we need to reconstitute the immune system. And so with that, I would like to thank the people who did the work. This is on a Greek motif, yeah, in honor of the postdoc Zeus there in the middle of the picture. And I put the names of the people who contributed substantially, as well as our collaborators and the funding sources, and of course all the women in the Canton de Vaud who agreed to participate in the study, and I thank you very much for your attention.